Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. David R. Harris. Harris is a professor of sociology at Cornell University. He also served as the first Robert S. Harrison Executive Director of the Institute for the Social Sciences from 2004 to 2007. Currently, he is the Deputy Provost for Social Services at Cornell. He is also the editor of The Colors of Poverty, Why Racial and Ethnic Disparities Persist, published by the Russell Sage Foundation in 2008. Welcome to the show, David. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Now, what was it that drew you to sociology in the first place?
Right. So I had a bit of an unusual trajectory, but one that I always often tell students the story because I think it's important. Too many students, I think, believe that somewhere at age 18 they need to know what they're going to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. And I was one of those students, and I went to Northwestern. I'm from Philadelphia area. I went to Northwestern University as an undergraduate and had never been west of Ohio. And I went there, journalism major, because it was the best journalism program in the country at that time. Mm-hmm. I was going to be a journalist. And I went, and about 3 weeks in, I thought, what was I thinking? I don't like journalism this much. I don't like it at all. I like it, but not that much. And so I thought, what do I like? And I switched from journalism to civil engineering, which was probably one of the few people to make that transition.
Yeah.
I thought, maybe that's what I like. Maybe that's what I was. And about a year and a half later, I dropped out of college. I was so miserable. And then I realized that I didn't hate school. I just hated engineering. I thought it was really important, and someone should care about building the bridges, but it just wasn't me. So I ended up looking through the course catalog and trying to figure out what I did care about, what motivated me, was interesting, and I realized I was analytical, but I cared about people and society, not about cable strength and bridges. And so I thought about social sciences in general and public policy, and I ended up getting an undergraduate degree in human development and social policy, and that's how I ended up there. And from there, I just
kept moving. Oh, how interesting! So you did a lot of experimenting before you landed there. That's good, probably, for a sociology person.
The more people do it, the better, I think.
Now, much of your research has been in regard to racial and ethnic identity, and in fact, you wrote a journal article called "Who Is Multiracial." Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that.
I think what a lot of research does is to take what we think are simple questions and to problematize them and show that actually they're a lot more complicated than we think, and not just as some fun intellectual exercise, I think, but importantly is to realize that in order to make good policy decisions in terms of social sciences where I do my work, it's important to problematize some of these things. Mm-hmm. And so a topic that's been of great interest to me for a long time, probably because I'm black, as a minority, is racial and ethnic identity and racial and ethnic inequality and what explains it, what explains racial disparities. And I grew up, when I was 8, we integrated the suburbs. Hmm. So I was in Philadelphia and we moved to a working class suburb in the outskirts of Philadelphia. And I was the first black kid in the Little League. It was that sort of experience in the 1970s. And what I realized was that race was much more complicated. I remember thinking about this very early, much more complicated than you would think if you simply paid attention to the way people spoke or paid attention to what you read in newspapers and books, because I was black, no doubt about it, but I was very different from most of my cousins who still lived in the city.
Hmm.
But I also wasn't exactly like my white friends who lived in the suburbs. And so right there early on, I started to think, this is much more complicated than we're giving it credit for.
Yes,
and when we
indeed.
Think about things like discrimination, the fact that I speak the way I do or that I have certain cultural capital from where I grew up means I'm not likely to be discriminated against in the same way as some of my relatives mm-hmm. who grew up in the central city. Doesn't mean I'm not, and I've been victim of discrimination as most minorities have, but it's different. And so that I think it's those early insights that started playing through my work. And multiracial is just in many ways the canary in the coal mine, is that by looking at individuals who are clearly racially ambiguous, or more plausibly racially ambiguous, mm-hmm. we gain insights that are quite instructive when we think about groups that we might not think are as racially ambiguous. And it applies to other things like gender as well.
Uh-huh.
So that's some of the kind of work
I'm
doing.
Do you think the definition of being racial or ethnic identities, is it fluid? Has it changed through the years since you've even been studying these issues?
Right, it certainly has. And so one of the insights I think that I brought to the work was to say that we often talk about the social construction of race, mm. and race is a social construct. And what I started to play with early on was, what does that mean? And when I say play with, I should be clear that I'm a sociologist, but I'm a quantitative sociologist, I'm a demographer, but also very theoretically motivated. So I like to start with hypotheses and theory, but I can't stop there. I then want to go out and say, all right, what's the data set? And for me, data set doesn't mean a small number of people I'd interview. It usually means the census or some huge survey to see if the patterns I find in the data are consistent with my expectations from theory. So think about social construct. The problem is that people often sort of mean by this that racial categories are not objective. They're not God-given somehow. Mm-hmm. And if you look in South Africa or you look in the islands or something, you will see the categories somewhat different. And my contention was that didn't really matter for policy. The key part of social construct was that not only is racial categories social constructs, but the allocation of individuals to these socially constructed categories is a social process. Once you realize that, then you've got a whole bunch of questions, things like, well, if we're interested in understanding rates of discrimination, do we use what people say their own race is, or do we use what people perceive their race to be? Well, these things give you different answers if it's a social process, and that's what we mean by it. And that's important if you're thinking about discrimination cases, if you're trying to understand poverty rates by race, a whole range of things. So that's where I end. That's where I ended up going.
Yeah, and that's when, and that's that does complicate things, indeed, right. as you say. Now, you wrote an article called "Does It Matter How We Measure Racial Classifications and the Characteristics of Multiracial Youth?" To talk to us about that. Are youth a little bit more into not wanting to identify as one race?
Well, if I ask you, I know you're the interviewer, but what's your name?
Tish Perlman.
Could you have answered that any other way?
I don't know.
Do you have a middle name?
Yeah.
Okay, you didn't give it to me.
Yeah.
Does that mean you don't know your middle name?
No.
Does it mean the question was ambiguous, right?
Exactly.
Right? It doesn't mean you're trying to evade your middle name, right? You could have said, you know, people often say, well, you know, someone calls me mom or dad, or my partner might call me some other name. So there's many ways
indeed
you could often answer those questions. It could have been Ms. Perlman or something. There's many things you could have said.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you don't know your name. It doesn't mean you're trying to avoid certain parts of it. It just means the question's ambiguous and your name is complicated. The same's true of race. If I say, what's your race, right? It seems like a simple question. Well, this paper sort of was one of the early papers I did that tried to point out and showed with data that that's actually multiple questions. So I've argued it's at least three questions. What's your race? One, based on what? So am I interested in your genetic ancestry? Am I interested in your phenotype, how you look? Am I interested in what's in your head, sort of ideology? That's one dimension. I could get different answers for you, perhaps, or certainly for individuals, depending on which of those I'm interested in. Second question, according to whom? Well, am I interested in what you think about yourself, what you articulate to others, or what they think about you with respect to race? And third, context. So if I'm thinking about how you look, and it's from my perspective, well, is it in this studio talking to you as an interviewer? Is it me seeing you at a conference for multiracial Americans? Where is it, right? Depending on where it occurs, I may well take your phenotypic cues and interpret them differently and consequently treat you differently. Last quick important point, this doesn't mean that race is completely a choice. So your listeners can't tell what I look like, but I think I'd have a very hard time saying, you know, as an Asian man, I don't think it's plausible, but I might be able to get away with saying, as a multiracial man, and you might say, okay, maybe. And so you don't have complete choice, but there is fluidity. And this paper used data to show that, for example, for Asian Americans, if you want to know, and this is a data set of middle school and high school kids from around the country, a large data set, if you want to know what percent of youth are biracial white Asian American, it depends how you ask the question. It depends if you ask the parents what their race is, if you ask the kid in a very confidential setting, if you have an interviewer who tends to be an adult, ask the kid, you get different answers.
Yeah.
And you can see this thing move in a significant way.
So is it hard to reach a real true conclusion in sociology because of this? I mean, you can skewer things, obviously, by asking different questions. People complain about that in polls and politics.
Right. Well, I think you have to have a theory. You have to be clear on what question you're asking. So when I say, what are rates of discrimination by race? And you could answer that in multiple ways. You could say, well, let's use based on what people say about themselves, or let's use observers, and we might get different answers, or whatever you want to use. You might use, for example, genes. And there's some recent research that shows, well, not in the last 5-6 years, that shows that there's a pretty high percentage of people who are identified as white and identified by others as white and identify themselves as white who have identifiable ancestry from Africa. Well, if you threw all those people in, you'd have even lower rates of discrimination, right? So you need to start by what do you mean by discrimination? And you just, in this case, you want to say, well, I'm interested in the choice set. I'm interested in those who are at risk of discrimination. If it's only somewhere deep in your genes, you can't be at risk because no one would know, including you. If it's something you think about yourself, but no one would know it by looking at you and you don't go around saying it, you can't be at risk.
Uh-huh.
And so that would lead you to say, when I'm doing that analysis, the data I want is observer race. I want to find some indicator and then say, those are the people at risk. Of those people, how many of them are discriminated against? So I think, to get back to your initial question, I think it is complicated. I think you can sort of distort it, if you will, but only if you don't have a clear sense of what your questions are and if your audience lets you off the hook and doesn't push you to ask exactly what you're trying to determine.
And that does go back to your statement that you do need to have a theory.
Yeah, it's
critical. You can't just start throwing questions out.
Well, people do, but it's not.
Yeah, but it's not the best way to do a study, I would say.
Yeah.
Now, there's an interesting subject that you've brought up that I'd like to delve into and see if it's evolved. You wrote a paper called Why Are Whites and Blacks Adverse to Black Neighbors?
Right.
Has that evolved? Has that changed? You wrote that in 2002 or something, right?
It was a fun title. I like titles. I knew that would get people's attention.
It got mine.
Yeah. So back at Michigan, I was at Michigan before I was at Cornell, and in most departments, job candidates come through, and you sort of start to know what kind of questions your colleagues are going to ask. And I think people probably knew Harris is going to ask this question, which is, you have a significant race coefficient on black. So it says blacks are significantly different from whites or Asians from whites, whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
Harris's question is almost always, why? What does that mean? Does that mean they're somehow genetically different? What's going on? And so this paper is an example of trying to take a race coefficient and really try to figure out what it means. And so here's the insight. It turns out if you ask whites to assess neighborhoods that they consider moving to, you show them a bunch of neighborhoods and say, it's been done in several ways, but you might say, here are cards that show 15 houses. The house you're considering is in the middle of this card. I'm going to show you the other houses. If you see white house, that means white people live there. If you see a black house, black people live there. You can do this with other races and so forth, or other groups, and say, tell me on a scale of 0 to 10 or whatever it is, how likely would you be, you think, to move into that neighborhood, assuming that the neighborhoods are similar in all other ways. And if you do this, you will find, and people have found, that whites are much more likely to choose neighborhoods that have very few black neighbors. It's less true than it was in the 70s, but it's still true. And people have taken this and said, use this to support discussions about white flight, right? About racism and so forth. And I thought, initially, this was my dissertation, is where this research started, this seemed way too simplistic. And there's this quote that I remember reading years ago now. Jesse Jackson said, when he walks down the street in D.C. and it's dark, and he turns around and the person behind him is white, he's relieved. And I thought, well, that's interesting.
I think I heard him say that.
And then I also thought, this will date myself, this is back in the early 90s, I thought, well, imagine that you have two options, a neighborhood of all white people, but they're all Jeff Dahmer.
This was
right around Chicago.
The killer,
he was in Wisconsin. I was in Chicago right at this time period. And imagine the other neighborhoods, all blacks, but they're all Michael Jordan. This was the Bulls in the heyday. Which neighborhood do you think whites would pick? There's no doubt in my mind they pick the Jordan neighborhood. Okay. What that tells you is race is proxying something. It's not just race. And so what I did in this paper was to take some data and show that finding for whites also holds for blacks. Blacks don't pick the all-black neighborhood either.
That's the part that fascinates me the most. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. David R. Harris. He's a sociology professor at Cornell University. Do you want to continue on that talk?
Sure.
Go right ahead.
So then the question becomes the title, why are whites and blacks averse to black neighbors? People have asked the question, why are whites averse to black neighbors, and said they're racist. Well, what about blacks? Is the same explanation? They're racist?
Is some of it the same reasons?
And so what I started to say is, wait a minute. Even when you tell people, imagine all things are similar, if you know anything about America, you know that a neighborhood with more blacks is, on average, going to be poorer, because blacks, on average, are about 2 to 3 times poorer than whites. You know that a neighborhood with more blacks is, on average, going to be a neighborhood that has schools that aren't quite as good. I mean, there's a whole higher crime. You know these
Absolutely.
Things. Intuitively,
yep.
If you're someone like me, you know it from the research. Or if you're in my class, you know it. Well, it's reasonable to think that some of what you're seeing in people saying, I don't want to live near blacks, is them saying, in the absence of strong information about these other things I care about, I'm going to avoid the black neighbors because that's the best way I can imagine right now, saying I want a neighborhood that has low poverty and so forth.
Yeah.
So what I did was to use data that asked people about a range of things, not just race, and then also used merged in data that was objective, so merged in census data to see what is the poverty rate in various neighborhoods and so forth, where they live, and check their behavior, not just what they say, but look at their behavior. And you end up finding that there's a huge non-racial effect. And so this is what I call the racial proxy hypothesis.
Uh-huh.
So yes, it's true that people want to avoid blacks, but they largely want to avoid poor neighborhoods and neighborhoods with high crime and bad schools and so forth. And some people are unhappy with me for this paper, this line of research, the argument being I was somehow ignoring the importance of race or wanting to apologize for race. I've said all along that if you're a good liberal person and you want to see everybody have equal opportunity, you better hope I'm right. Because if I'm wrong, then what's the policy option?
Uh-huh.
Whites don't want to live near blacks. What do you do? Well, unless you think something else matters, right, you got no option. You have to wait decades and generations until this stuff fades away. But if I'm right, then you can imagine saying, look, if there's a neighborhood that's integrating, we better really focus on the schools in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
We better really focus on crime. We better make sure that we do what we can in subtle ways to make sure people know this is a great neighborhood with lots of opportunities and wonderful schools. That's what you want to do. And so that's the line of, that was that whole line of work.
Very interesting. That's a fascinating subject to me. Poverty has been one of your big issues.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote that book, The Colors of Poverty, Why Racial and Ethnic Disparities Persist. Let's talk about that.
Sure.
You know, almost 50 years after LBJ's war on poverty, where are we?
Well, I guess I'll answer the question with the quote. I had the incredible pleasure of interviewing a civil rights leader. This was in the late 90s, in Martin Luther King's old office in Atlanta.
Mm.
My colleague asked the question, actually, have things gotten any better? And I thought, oh, boy, you know, of course they got better. And the person laughed. And he said, well, there aren't dogs trying to chew on my leg. That's better.
Wow.
But, in many ways, not so much. They've gotten a lot more complicated. And so the person then went on to tell us a story in Atlanta that they were having a very difficult time getting one of the suburban areas to align its public transportation stops with the city of Atlanta's public transportation stops. And so when Atlanta would move its bus stop to a certain corner, the other place would move theirs a ways away. And which made it very difficult for people in Atlanta to get to jobs in the suburb that had lots of jobs.
Uh-huh.
It just wasn't, you couldn't do it if you didn't have a car. And he's saying that's something that's very subtle. And it's there if you look and you know where to look, but it's very subtle and it's also very difficult to fight. Where a sign that says, you know, whites only, that's easy, relatively, I'm not minimized, that's relatively easy.
Well, it's absolutely honest.
Exactly. And you go after that. If I get that sign down, you can go there. Great. This case, you can tell stories about why you have to put the bus stop here or there. And so one of the things we find is that if you look at the poverty rates and how the gap, black, white, or Latino, white, for example, has looked over time, you see a very wide gap. Blacks and Latinos 2 to 3 times more likely than whites to be poor.
Yeah.
And Asians being more similar to whites, by the way, in terms of poverty.
Uh-huh.
And you see things getting a little better sometimes, but you see it still in this band. It sort of moves in and out, but you can see these large gaps.
And what do you think the reason is, though? I mean, have you come up with anything?
So that's what the book was about. So
uh-huh.
This is a project that I started and then had another person join me, and we were the co-editors on the book and wrote the first chapter and basically led the effort on all the other chapters, finding authors, pushing them on what to do, and so forth. We said this was the book we went to graduate school to read.
Ah.
Because the question was simply, remember the whole Harris question from Job Talks? Why? What does that mean? What's going on?
Uh-huh.
And we found it frustrating that there was far too much work that documented, okay, you can see it here in poverty, you can see it here in unemployment, here's how the trend looks, and not enough of the why. And so we pulled together some of the best folks in the country on particular mechanisms. So sometimes people will say it's culture, or it's education, or it's social networks. We said, well, great, let's get the best person we can find on social networks, and let's ask that person to go in detail and say, how do social networks affect poverty? How might the social network effects vary across racial groups? How much does this explain of the racial disparities? So we did this across a number of mechanisms. And the surprise to us was that every one of the authors came back independently, and they all said the same thing. Basically, they said, this is an important mechanism of understanding poverty. We believe that it affects racial groups differently, but it's not the smoking gun. You know, if you were able, and we also went through some policies that might be effective.
Uh-huh.
They said, if you were able to completely eliminate racial differences in social networks and sort of people getting jobs that way,
mm-hmm.
we don't think it would have a huge difference in the poverty rate difference. And we then realized, my co-editor and I, as we sat through and read these chapters and thought about what the authors had been telling us, we realized what they were basically saying was a cumulative disadvantage story.
Ah.
And I illustrate it often by saying, imagine there's a stream, and the stream's running, and you want to stop that stream. And you say, I'm going to throw this little rock into the stream. What would happen? Well, what would happen is the water would divert around that. It'd be slowed a little bit, but it would still end up where it was going, downstream.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. There's so many factors. When you think about someone you know who's particularly privileged or particularly underprivileged, and you think about all the ways in which that person's different from someone on the other end of the extreme, you think, you know, if you suddenly just dealt with the social network effect or dealt with discrimination or dealt with any one of these things,
mm-hmm.
it's a pebble. There's so many things for affluent kids where their parents will come in or their other folks will come in and they live in a good neighborhood, so the schools are good, right? You have to put in a dam. And so that's where we started talking about comprehensive policy. You have to have a comprehensive policy on poverty. You can't just look at any single factor,
mm-hmm.
which is what
mm-hmm.
oftentimes people think about.
They do. I mean, a lot of people just say racism. Mm-hmm. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah,
why.
It's only part of it.
Yeah. And a lot of people keep focusing on the fact that more and more African Americans have moved into the middle class, but they forget that there's still more and more people moving into poverty. So one wonders if anything really has changed.
Well, one of the reasons they forget is because we have extremely high levels of segregation in this country by socioeconomic status.
If and class, right?
That's what I meant.
What
yeah,
do you mean by
that's
class?
What I mean. Yeah,
yep.
by class.
Yep.
If you're an affluent person, you don't really interact with poor people. You interact with them as they serve you in certain places, but your kids generally don't go to school with them. They're not in your church. They're not in your clubs. You don't really know them. And that's a huge shift from what you saw in the U.S. at an earlier time before you had massive suburbanization, which was facilitated in part by highways and other things,
oh,
and
yeah.
riots in
uh-huh.
the cities.
Uh-huh.
You would have found people coming into close contact and understanding these things better. Right now you say, well, I don't know, I have a Latino who works with me, so maybe things are better for them. And you don't see all the Latinos in poverty who don't work, who don't live anywhere near
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah, that's a false feeling of yeah. accomplishment.
Yeah.
Now, you also wrote an article about how poverty is measured. You wrote an article called Poverty Research and Anti-Poverty Policy After the Technological Revolution. Has measuring poverty and measuring some of the stuff that you do as a sociologist changed because of
yeah.
high tech?
Well, this particular article was in a larger book that was about measuring poverty. My particular piece, I tell my students sometimes that I often feel like the bearer of bad news. It's sort of a downer coming to my class. The issue here was the digital divide, which many people heard
yes.
about.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that, and this is an article written in the late 90s, having access to the internet is increasingly advantageous for schoolwork, for jobs, for a whole range of things.
And networking,
exactly.
going back to what we were talking
yep.
about. Yep.
And there are huge disparities by race in access to computers and access to internet.
Still.
Mm-hmm. And you put these two things together and you say, wait a minute, the internet, which has the potential to disrupt systems of discrimination, for example, because when, you know, I'm interacting with somebody about a job or housing, I'm emailing back and forth, especially when you have a name like David Harris. Nobody knows my race.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so if they would say, I wouldn't rent this to a black guy, well, by the time they meet me and they know my race, we're already pretty far down the road. They don't have the opportunity to say there is no unit as easy.
Uh-huh.
So it has the potential to reduce your disparities. But when you realize that this is the digital divide, you say, oh, my God, this increasing technological revolution, it actually could exacerbate racial and ethnic disparities because of differential access. So that's what I showed, again, theory and then with data.
God, that amazes me that there's still so much disparity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I worked many years ago trying to get computers in the schools, in some of the poorer schools here in Ithaca. It's amazing that it's still going on.
Yep.
Now, let's talk about the election of Barack Obama. How has that changed your perspective as a sociologist and as a black man in general?
It was an incredibly emotional experience for me.
Uh-huh.
Much more so than I imagined it was going to be. I had no idea. I was paying very close attention to the election. But somehow, going into that booth, and it was the tile with the curtain that comes behind you, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And going in there and seeing Barack Obama, a black guy, by the way, a black guy who has a white mom and grew up with his white relatives.
That's right, talking about multiracial.
Back to my research. And seeing him as someone I could vote for, not because he's black, not as a, well, I don't know if he's the best candidate or he's my best choice, but oh, it'd be great to see a minority in there. But to say, this guy seems to be, as best I can tell, highly qualified and so
uh-huh.
forth, and I'd vote for him even if you were a white guy. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And realizing that people were doing this around the country, And to think that, you know, my parents, my dad's passed